This is CBS World News. Allied troops are making good progress in their drive on the French Riviera. We've taken two islands off the coast and Cape Negre, 28 miles east of Toulon. There's still no word of any strong German resistance. In Normandy, however, the Germans are fighting bitterly in many places inside the closing pocket. Allied troops are moving in and have captured enormous stores of material. About 3,500 American and British heavy bombers and fighters dropped nearly 9,000 tons of explosives on enemy air bases in France, the Low Countries, and Germany. This broadcast has come to you from CBS World News. We now resume our scheduled program.
Columbia presents Corwin. Tonight, Norman Corwin brings you the last program in his special series for Columbia, a soliloquy with accessories entitled, There Will Be Time Later. House Jameson, distinguished actor of radio and stage, will appear as the soliloquist, and the original musical score has been composed and is conducted by Bernard Herrmann. House Jameson in Norman Corwin's There Will Be Time Later. This is the moment to dig in. There will be time later for the dish that takes 2 days to make, and the collection of stamps from occupied countries, and the novel in 7 volumes that will be finished, if all goes well, by the turn of the decade. There will, of course, be many a pretty actress on the cover of Life, and it's conceivable that fishing in the high Sierras will range from good to wonderful indefinitely. Meanwhile, your son and your neighbors awake 10,000 miles apart to the alarums of one war. The road bomb drops in Aldich, and the girl in the white dress to whom you were talking a minute ago is inside out and bloody and hardly to be salvaged for a decent burial. It is certain that medicine will sooner or later turn up with a low-priced cure for sinusitis, and that post-war horses will run well in Suffolk Downs and Hialeah, and the ballet will develop a 6-day wonder with matinees on Wednesday and Saturday. But today, 3 continents and archipelagos unnumbered crawl with armor, and patriots listen through a blacked-out night for sounds of vengeance in the suburbs. There will be a time later when assorted airplanes, having retired, having pigeoned home from the Balkans to the plains of Texas, from the atolls of green Pacific seas to the formal hangars of March Field, having flown a quiver with triumph straight through layers of war and weather to the designated ports, will, duly upon arrival and after reasonable interval, be shuffled and assembled for the victory parade. The advance notices will not exaggerate. Hundreds of miles long, mind you, and taking hours to pass a given bleacher seating the committee on arrangements. It will be a fair day in summer, ceiling unlimited, with a snicker of wind and a cloud or two. And in proud ships named Dopey, Easy Ace, and Jack the Giant Killer will be born beribboned airmen, flak-free, rudder-steady, kidding on the intercom, aircraft-friendly, sighted at 11, 7, 6, 3, 4, and 12 o'clock. The county sky will beat with a terrible biblical noise. And you will run up to your roof with your firstborn, and he will blink at the sun and sneeze, and you will point up with an index finger.
See the pretty airplanes, Tommy?
And his mouth will be open, and his eyes behold the eclipse of 1,000,000 square miles of firmament. But nothing of it will he understand, although he be told and told again. Yet when he is old, and we are gone, and the planes long junked, he will still remember the sunny morning and the roar that frightened him at first, and how that afternoon his father took him to a movie, first one he had ever seen.
Hey,
permissible for us to crow for 20 minutes and be happy. To enjoy the late communiques at dinner this fine evening in this brightening world. But neither you nor I must overdo it. For only this fine morning over picturesque terrain, a soldier with the glory of Tunisia well behind him, with Cherbourg in his back pocket and republics in his debt, inched forward on his belly confidently, as he had done successfully before, and drew a bead. He was unaware at the time of the optimistic tone of the Associated Press war summary, and likewise witless of the firm closing of stocks last evening. Steele had a notably good day. By night, he was beyond receiving range of the dream of the radio writer published on the unjammed air of America. For he was clipped by a bullet at 9:45 on the nose, and henceforward must be numbered among the grand total of casualties. 30% below expectations as of the first D-Day, plus 70. As he is dead, no one can speak for him concerning love and death and politics and taxes. Yet it is reasonably safe to assume that he would be amazed to hear the war is won, that the whole thing's over, and that from here on in, it's a breeze. It didn't seem that way to him this morning, when he was clipped, as I say, by a hostile bullet as he crawled on assignment toward the German border. So if we're crowing, thanks to him, because the news is good, is wonderful, is getting better, let us crow for 20 minutes only and get back to work. Later, when the horsemen of apocalypse ride in from the quadrants of the earth and pull up by a misty woods back of an old battleground, and the one whose name is Conquest will dismount, and he will break his bow upon his knee and trample it. He will wipe blood from both hands on the hide of his snow-white horse, and turn and fade into the mists. And the one whose name is War will grasp his great sword by the hilt and circle it round his head and fling it far, and it will shatter on the crosses of fallen soldiers. And the dead young men will hear the sound, though their thoughts be distant and their bones be interstitched with grass. And the saddle of the red horse shall be empty. And the one called Famine will drop his balances, remembering the look of the rich wheat fields upon the way. And he too will alight and skulk into the darkest shadows of the woods, taking care to avoid the barest touch of the seed of the meanest fruit. And only the rider by the name of Death will sit still on the pale horse and listen for sounds in the wind and turn away in the direction of the west, leaving the riderless horses to graze forever on substances of night. Now, a compound fracture is a wicked thing, and so is a missing part. For nature, in all its wisdom, and notwithstanding its proven generosity, made no allowances for blast. Shrapnel, too, was outside the reckoning of sperm and ovum. And the misfortunes of this oversight may be read in the charts of men on the ambulance trains. You must admit that however tomorrow may be planned, whether the barn is to be converted to a studio, whether the lecture season of the Women's Club will extend to June and will include a two-piano recital, as it did last year, whether Liberia will subscribe to the Inter-Allied Monetary Plan and Pan American be given the polar route to Moscow, there will be a noticeable limp, always, in certain of our company. and a sharp twinge in the vicinity of the scar tissue come rainy weather. And the boy with the clear blue eyes, who was valedictorian of his high school class and who wanted to marry Selma as soon as he got back, will look out at the world from a mateless bed, trying to recall his name and the outline of an image hidden deep down in a tangle of debris. And naturally, there will be opportunity later for adjustment of the tax rates. But in the meantime, the medicine stands on the white tray and is taken every 2 hours, night and day. And the tattered face is built up, cartilage by cartilage, and the bone knits slowly.
How's the old back feel today, Johnny?
And the brisk and busy nurse comes with the clean sheets to the speechless psycho case and talks a good line even though he cannot answer. The boy grins, without reference to the facts of his case, his intellect having been destroyed by a landmine below Avranches. And while the nurse lifts him...
That's it, Dolly. That's a good boy.
He smiles, as an infant smiles. Not because the world is happy, or a neat joke has been made, but because our kind are born benign with goodness in them. And even before the senses grow to any shape, or after they are sprung apart with age, or idiocy, or hard knocks, still the germplasm of our species has a smile for you. This is the very moment to dig in. There will be time later for the solemn commemoration of the great event and the cantata sung by massed choirs over the combined networks. The outstanding poet of the war will emerge and be honored by the Poetry Society. And in the fall catalog of a leading publisher will be announced a striking new history of the military strategy of World War II, telling, among other things, how the fox was foxed and how the intuition of the supreme Aryan was frustrated by a Jewish general in the direction of East Prussia. The Museum of Modern Art will find exhibitable matter in the films and archives, maps and camouflage of battle. And in the classroom, the children, not yet here this evening, but awaiting the return of fathers from the sundry fronts, thence presently to be conceived, will take their seats quietly and listen.
What we're going to hear in these records, boys and girls, are the sounds of war made during the Great Blitz and the Battle of Britain. First of all, you'll hear the sound of a warden's patrol going about its duty on a London street in the blackout during an air raid. The recording was made on the night of September 27th, 1940, and is authentic. I mean, it's not fake, it's the real thing.
In the long view backward shall not the hobnail of the home guard scuffing the sidewalk make as loud a ringing as a clash of swords against Achilles' shield? Who shall bookkeep the glory of this war? Is the farmer boy who dove his trainer straight into the earth from 15,000 feet? A mistake, mark you, but it was at night and his first try at flight by instrument alone. Is he so far beneath a hero as to be out countenance? Hallowed be the anti-fascist hobnail on cement.
And now we'll hear various types of guns used in World War II. First, the Bren gun. It's a small automatic weapon made at low cost but very effective. It was often dropped by parachute to the brave men of the underground and to partisan fighters.
A gun may stutter, but it knows what it wants to say.
This one is the sound of a trench mortar used so successfully by our great Russian allies to turn back the Nazis, which gave us time to get ready to strike from the west.
Oh, little bullfrog, who scattered panzers in the dead of winter, the city of Lenin and the Kremlin walls shall remember you. Also the banks of the Don and Volga, the Thames and Mississippi.
Now here's the sound of a 75-millimeter field gun fired by a British gun crew in the First Battle of France.
Not contained on the same side of the disc, for a class so young, is the color of the French valley that fall morning, and the posture, name, and former occupation of the dead Tommy 15 feet away. Also the smell of powder in the burnt nostril, sweat under the honest armpits, the letter in the gunner's breast pocket concerning how a fascist mission 12 days ago destroyed two streets of workers' homes in Swansea. Later, to be explained to the advanced classes, will be how the 75s had to take over when petitions failed. How in the first place the valley was betrayed by Sharpies, their home offices in unexpected places, high and low. The teacher will gather up the records and examine them for flaws, inasmuch as they are to be played again tomorrow. Meanwhile, as of the instant hour, the anti-fascist hobnails scuff along in Kensington, and the patrols of Glasgow swing into their fifth year. The stuttering Bren has stitched another German gut in a hedgerow of the district Orn, and the bullfrog croaks nightlong in the bogs of Lithuania. There will be time later for the staple things. Love will occur again, between four walls and out of the way of the weathers. Eyes will have license to glow in the light that slants through Venetian blinds, and lips kissed in the secret hours will speak again the ancient sweet felicities of lovers. The earth can be relied upon to conspire and assist, performing as a mutual friend, and the moon will once more be in character. The heart of man has four chambers, and each shall be filled with tremors in the spring. The season of summer shall insinuate with song and evidences of fertility. Whereas the autumn, by incendiary measures, shall inflame the woods and demonstrate how it is possible to grow old without loss of beauty. Winter, with its stern outlook and its northern bearing, will merely underscore the warmth of the most ordinary bed, however cold the room, providing it is justly shared. Thus will the planet, busy as it is between this solstice and the next, help out a man and woman, and the race, a staple always, will continue. Meanwhile, the spleen of man is in command of him and not his heart. Your brother and your grocer's kid, one in the hellish heat of Aden and the other in the clammy Pribilofs, have been a year without a glimmer of a girl. The word has gone among the vine ropes of New Guinea to the jungle fighters from East Boston and Seattle that a nurse, a living female, uniformed but of a shape distinct and recognizable as that of woman, has arrived and may be gandered for a short time only before she flies on to the Marianas. And in the hothouse evening, through the strangling green of tropic bush, the hungry soldiers, bearded, sweaty, hike for miles down to the airstrip just to gaze in silence from 50 feet away upon the constellation of a single girl. A flash of golden hair, a sparkle of white teeth, and trim American ankles. And in this shining symbol, conspicuous and jeweled as a meteor in a moonless sky, the GI sees his wife, his honey, and his hope. She is all things ever said and done between the two. The walking on the beach, the first kiss in the rumble seat. Her profile proud across the dining room. Hands held in church.
Dawn through the screen door tincturing her hair.
Double features at the palace. Artificial stars but air-conditioned in the summer. Bridge at the Obers. Pregnancy. Her mother was a great help toward the end of it. Flower somehow in a dim, lost evening gown packed in a trunk in mothballs. Waiting for B-29s to finish off in Tokyo. Waiting for a thrust of Rokossovsky's army on the Eastern Front. Waiting for the trap door under Hesse's gallows. War has the voice of a million muzzles, and where it speaks, dust hangs in the air for weeks. Violence is consummate. The overtaken cow lies with burst udder on the hummock. No worm is safe. The bomb digs deeper than the mole. All creatures living in the earth and air, entire censuses of seas, have felt the shock. The twin screws of the dreadnought scatter seaweed. Depth bombs blow up whole nations of schooling fish, while in the heavens, the eagle is outflown or mangled on the tail assembly, and spores are liquidated in the vapor trails. Every leaf, every frond knows all about it, and the humus in the ground is hep, and even neutral mountains are aware, a hemisphere distant, for the crust of the globe is fairly resilient and will instantly transmit a jolt in China to the confidential seismographs of Colorado. As I say, all fish and fowl have heard about it, but the pompous editor has not. With malice aforethought, he signals the press room and transforms anonymous wood pulp into a published lie. The dancers of Bali can give eyewitness information, and the children of Kamchatka make report. But from the unimpressed politico, who has not heard the tidings, expects no more than local and continued mouthing, stale and immoderate with increasing wind. This is the year for it. Evil is more devious than at first believed, and the incident in the garden has been improved on many times. The mere fact that the noisome newspaper is published, recognized, and carried through the mails doesn't automatically mean it's any good. Poison is poison, even if it sells for soda pop. And when the candidate for district office runs against the dead and wounded, saying they died for exactly nothing, then the tactics call for you to take pins from the battle map of southern France and stick them in the county seat. War has a voice of a million muzzles, which, though amplified by death and taxes, still is a whisper in the ear of him who tells you, take it easy, slow down, neighbor, take it easy, hold things in the bag. He's deafer than he's dumb, this man, for though you shout to him,
war, war, a war is on,
he'll be absorbed in the four-point landing of a mosquito, detectable by its faint, high hum. You can cry to him,
look to the east. Your countrymen die for the cause and you.
And he will look at his navel through which turns the axis of the earth. You can admonish him.
We're liberating Europe. We advance on all the fronts. The armies of free people are driving to Berlin.
And he will make tidy notes of the campaign and predict new landings, urge reconversion to ping pong paddles in a letter to the Times. Corner the market on Modigliani's and buy up first editions, but no war bonds. And when you talk to him of post-war plans for unemployment, he will say,
why should we bother with the great unwashed?
At that point, you can break the news to him that it's the great unwashed who wash away the stains of high corruption. The common man unmanicured whose hand prevails against the elite guard. That the people shall come before the princes in the alphabet of things. And in the eyes of free men now and ever hence, the unwashed shall be white as snow, even if the dirt and smell of battle lingers on them for a generation. Some things can wait and some things can't. The paint job can hold over, but the blueprints had better move along. There will be time later for the train trip to visit the folks on the coast. But at the moment, George's teeth should be seen to. There will be time later for the dividend and for further findings from a bathysphere. The lot on the California hilltop can afford to wait until after the cellars of Warsaw are cleaned out. But in the meantime, non-committal mailmen keep distributing familiar greetings from the president. Form 215 for pre-induction physical. The boys who passed their physical some time ago die on a sand dune with the sense of winning in them, their last frame of life being the forward movement of their comrades. Meantime, the soul of man emerges quickly from the caves and sewers. Truth, revised, expanded, unabridged, stirs from among the ashes of burnt books. The essence of dignity, last seen hurriedly packing a bag in a hotel in Munich, picks itself up from the gutter where the old Jew lay beaten and bleeding. The dream of hale and hairy-chested amity flies on the shuttle route from Oxfordshire to Minsk. The key is heard turning in the barbed wire cage mid the clamors of the box barrage. And liberty, that dog-eared parchment signed by Christ, the angels, and a most impressive list of sponsors, big and little, arrives at your front door in the morning.
I've been listening to House Jameson in There Will Be Time Later, written, directed, and produced by Norman Corwin as the last program in his special series for Columbia. The musical score was composed and conducted by Bernard Herrmann.
This is Norman Corwin. We've come to the end of another series, and in this last few moments, I'd like to tell you how deeply grateful I am for the wonderful letters you've written in the course of these 22 programs. They've really been a source of inspiration and of great encouragement. And if there have been worthwhile things done at this microphone, you should assume a large part of the credit. Nor can I leave the air without acknowledging publicly my indebtedness to Ronald Dawson, Charles Lewin, Richard Sandville, Lou Sawyer, and Martha Willard for their services, extraordinary, as well as to the many actors, musicians, composers, and technical men who've brought these plays to the air. And so, good night, goodbye, and the thanks of myself, our company, and the network, this being CBS, the Columbia Broadcasting System.